I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Lois Rudnick. She is a historian, and she is here with us today to talk about the crisis in Central America, the refugee situation, and the historical roots of that region and what's going on there. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. I'm very glad to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about the scope of the crisis, the migrant and refugee crisis, and maybe contextualize that in this world of refugees that we're living in today.
Sure. I think it's probably a shocking statistic for most people to hear that there are 50 million refugees globally today.
Oh, my goodness.
50% of them are children. And we're probably more familiar with the Syrian crisis that has generated 3 million refugees. And I like to talk about that because it puts in perspective our own refugee crisis that has been happening over the last couple of years, in largest numbers and over the last year. We have encouraged Turkey to take in 1 million refugees from the Syrian civil war. Jordan has taken in 2 million refugees from the Syrian civil war. And we are dealing here with, in the last year, 2014, 57,000 children, unaccompanied children, who have come to the United States.
And if you look at the geographical size and wealth disparity between the United States mm-hmm. and Turkey and Jordan put together.
Yes, you would find it quite astonishing that anyone, even a Republican from the southern part of New Mexico, could suggest that we are being overwhelmed by a border crisis. It's a refugee crisis. It is a humanitarian crisis similar to what is happening in Syria and that has happened in the Sudan and other areas from which we have taken in refugees into our country over the last 40 years there is no reason we can't deal with equitably.
So the scope of the crisis to us seems rather large. Okay, 50,000 people, 100,000 people, maybe next year, whatever. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about why it's happening. I mean, yep. I remember I came of age in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was giving, I remember this number, $1 million a day
yes.
to the Contras in Nicaragua,
right.
who seemed to be a band of really not very nice people.
Right-wing death squad
death
thugs
squads,
would be a polite way to describe them.
And they were blowing up health centers and school buses mm-hmm. and taking away people's land. And it was a horror show.
Right.
And that is not unrelated to, I mean, that is
right.
related. These things
right.
are
yes.
all links. So
as an historian who recognizes that most of my fellow Americans, and this is not a criticism of them, it's just a truth of how much information we are overloaded with every day, don't have a long historical memory, you cannot understand the refugee crisis that we are experiencing right now on the Rio Grande border without going back and looking at the U.S. policies in Central America, really starting in the late 19th century, but we don't have time to go back that far, but at least since the time of the civil wars that decimated the economy and the villages and the peoples of El Salvador and Guatemala in particular, and Nicaragua as well. If you will indulge me, I'd like to quote a really pithy, very pithy summary of the historic nature of this problem from a Santa Fe resident whom I don't know, but who wrote an extraordinary letter to the New York Times on June 10th of this year, Roger Carrasco.
Okay.
He says, the three countries sending the most children, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, are the, quote, three death squad torture-practicing countries we have been arming and supporting for decades. He concludes, quote, we are reaping what we have sown at least since the 1980s, but if you want to go back to the impact of the United Fruit Company and other companies that have controlled hundreds of thousands of acres of land in these countries since the late 19th century, it goes back much further. I also just briefly want to quote a quote from Bishop Oscar Romero, the El Salvadorian bishop who was assassinated 3 hours after he spoke these words in his church. Each week I go about the country. This is 1980, March 24th. Each week I go about the country listening to the cries of the people, their pain from so much crime, and the ignominy of so much violence. Of the 26 military men who came into the church to kill him, the majority of them were trained at the School for Americas, an institution I want to talk about, along with some of the other historic origins of why we have this refugee crisis. If we go back to the 1980s, particularly for El Salvador and Guatemala, we're talking about two countries that suffered horrendous civil wars because of tremendous human oppression, genocide, social injustice. And these are wars that the United States fully supported to the tune of $1 million a day, not just in Nicaragua. This was also true in the 1980s under Reagan for El Salvador and for Guatemala as well.
Why was the United States supporting those countries and supporting the really torture death squad, I mean, really horrifying activities?
Right-wing dictatorships, yeah. Military dictatorships. What was going on in Central America and elsewhere in the world was essentially a proxy. These are proxy wars for the Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR. So from Reagan's perspective and his administration's perspective, essentially the Marxist-led insurgents who were fighting the dictatorships that the United States was supporting with military and economic aid were, in a sense, part of the greater communist conspiracy to take down the United States of America. And so the argument was, even under the Carter administration, Congress had managed to pass legislation saying that we could not send military aid to countries that had had violent civil rights abuses. And Amnesty International and America Watch had shown again and again that these abuses were going on in these countries. So what Reagan's administration did was to claim that there were no human rights violations going on. And in 1983, he reinstituted the military aid to these countries that went into the hundreds of billions by the time these wars were over. The civil war actually in Guatemala began in 1960. The peace accords weren't signed until 1996. The civil war in El Salvador began in 1980, and the peace accords weren't signed until 1992. Probably most Americans of our generation remember the Iran-Contra scandal, and there the United States government was not supporting Marxist-led guerrillas who were fighting governments who were slaughtering union leaders and students and nuns and priests and ordinary peasants, but we were supporting right-winged military who were trained in Honduras for many years. And when the funds were cut off from the U.S. legislature, we know that Oliver North became a conduit for the Reagan administration and got $360 million worth of funding from the Saudi Arabians and the Israelis to eventually arm 18,000 of these right-wing death squads who caused the death of 40,000 people in Nicaragua.
And when you talk about 18,000 death squads, imagine
18,000 people who are part of these.
Right, people. Imagine training 18,000 Americans to carry out those kinds of activities in the 50 states. Now imagine a country the size of Nicaragua or Honduras or El Salvador, each one of which would fit into probably Vermont.
Right, exactly. And the Sandinistas who were ruling in Nicaragua were considered to be Marxists. They were Marxists. And the reason that we were, again, this was part of a Cold War proxy war that was happening under the radar of the United States Congress until it finally, you know, was brought forth in 1989.
And under the radar, it's true, but I remember reading groups like Witness for Peace and groups of nuns who were bringing it to everybody's attention.
Yes.
So it was like under the radar, but it was right there for everybody to know.
It was right there for everybody to know. And Americans began to take notice when priests and nuns were killed, when Oscar Romero was assassinated in 1980. Several years later, there were several priests who were killed, and innocent women and children. And that's when, it was in the early 80s, that the American religious community began to take note, and the sanctuary movement began. And I'd like to say a little bit about that, because the sanctuary movement is being regenerated and reborn as we speak. The sanctuary movement began in the Presbyterian, Southside Presbyterian Church and Quaker Meeting House in Tucson, Arizona in 1980, when Reverend Fife looked at the stream of refugees that were coming to the United States beginning in 1980. 2 million El Salvadorian and Guatemalan people were displaced and became refugees during the 1980 civil wars. 1 million of them came to the United States. In 1980, there were 335,000 Central American immigrants in this country. By 2012, there are 3 million Guatemalan and El Salvadorian-born immigrants living in this country. And when the religious leaders began to take notice, because the death squads were targeting priests and nuns who were part of the liberation theology movement in Central America that began in the 1960s, they began to consider using the process of sanctuary, which has existed probably since before the Middle Ages, as a way of someone going to a church whose life is in danger and saying, protect me, give me asylum. And so they began a movement where they very publicly decided that they would not listen to what the law was. After 2 years of trying to get protection for undocumented immigrants fleeing the civil wars in Central America, they got nowhere. Essentially, the United States had a no-refugee policy. Only 2 to 3% of those who petitioned for asylum were able to get asylum. So these ministers and later rabbis and priests said, we are going to publicly flaunt the INS using the Nuremberg principles from the Nazi trials in post-World War II Germany and using the arguments from the abolitionists of the 19th century and using the civil disobedience principles of the civil rights movement in the South. In fact, many of the leaders of the sanctuary movement got their first licks in the South doing civil disobedience during the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. By 1985, there were 150 churches and synagogues who were involved in this movement, and 1,000 other churches and synagogues who did not take in refugees, but who approved of what these other churches were doing.
And so what would happen? Their congregation would have members of it who would take a family or a child? Or
They would take families into the church. They would feed them, clothe them. They would find them jobs. They would provide them pro bono lawyers for making their cases. And a coalition of these sanctuary religious organizations got together. And in 1985, an extremely important contest went to the courts called the Baptist Church versus Thurnberg, in which the ministerial leaders and the lawyers were arguing that most of the refugees who had not yet been deported should be given sanctuary, refugee status here in the United States, because the decisions made against giving them refugee status were based on foreign policy ideas, not on our own laws for the protection of refugees. And so in 1990, the courts agreed, and they said any immigrant who came, any refugee who came from Central America by 1990 had a right to be protected and stayed here and be given refugee status. It was an extraordinary victory and a completely justified victory in accordance with U.S. own laws on refugee status for that to have happened. And it was done because so many of the refugees came here, formed organizations that were fighting for the protection of immigrants. Thousands of lawyers were willing to work pro bono for them. And religious leaders of moral conscience from every congregation in the country were willing to argue on both the moral and legal validity of this process, given the role of the United States in fomenting these civil wars, in providing billions of dollars worth of military aids to brutally corrupt leaders in these wars.
We're talking to historian Lois Rudnick. I often wonder What would have been the outcome had the United States, I mean, name your conflict, but let's take this conflict, had different leadership and decided not to intervene and not to be fighting proxy wars against the Soviet Union that played out in these tiny little agricultural indigenous countries and just devastated them in ways that are not only having human consequences today, but also environmental consequences. Yes. And so what if we just stayed home and spent that money on public schools? What would have happened in Central America?
Or what if we, seeing the poverty and the tremendous natural disasters that have happened in this part of the world in the last 40 or 50 years, what if we had decided to invest in the economic and educational infrastructures of these countries?
Right. And, you know, that's a different question. And the United States intervenes in all kinds of ways.
Yes,
and
we
sometimes
do.
Our aid is not very helpful.
Correct.
Sometimes it is. But what if we just stayed the heck out?
I don't know how that could have happened, given the fact that you have multinational corporations like United Fruit Company going into these countries and appropriating lands and refusing to pay taxes. Let me give you a fabulous historical example of what you're asking about. A few years ago, Steve and I went to Costa Rica, and I brought with me a 900-page book of primary source documents to read about the history of Costa Rica, because I was amazed by the fact they were the only country in Central America that never had a civil war. Well, Honduras technically hasn't either, but they have had a slew of horrendous leaders taking most of the country's property into the hands of those who are the wealthiest. So I said, why has Costa Rica never had a civil war? Why is it a country that's been at peace? Well, lo and behold, there were two pieces of information I discovered that were fascinating. One was a letter written by the head of the United Fruit Company, which was in Costa Rica, as well as many of the other countries of Central and South America, asking the ambassador of the United States under Franklin Roosevelt during the 1940s if the United States could intervene because the government was wanting to tax some of the foreign investors and landowners in the country, and they didn't want to have to pay any taxes. And the ambassador from the United States wrote back to the head of the United Fruit Company, "The United States under the Roosevelt administration does not engage in policies of the overthrow of governments." 3 years later, the president of Costa Rica, Figueroa, banished the military. So there was no one to corrupt. Now, there are other reasons why Costa Rica has fared much better. The fact that most of their indigenous populations were wiped out long ago, unlike Guatemala, in which the Mayans still are a majority, and Ladinos, mixed-race people, are a majority of the population. 200,000 Mayans were killed during the Guatemalan Civil War. So you look at a country like Costa Rica, where you had, fortunately, at a time when the United Fruit Company wanted intervention, an ambassador who said, "We don't do that," and an intelligent, he was a military leader, but he said, "We're banishing the military." So there's no police, there's no military to corrupt. It is the militaries that have supported these dictatorships with the help of the oligarchies, who are the richest people in these countries, that have made the lives of their citizens impossible, so difficult, the lives of the peasantry in particular.
Now, there was not only, I mean, we're talking about this gigantic migration of Central American refugees, particularly in the 1980s, there were also deportations that play from the United States back to Central America that play a role in the current crisis.
Absolutely. Starting in 1992, after the LA riots, the federal government began to treat some of the juvenile gang members who were in Los Angeles as felons. And in the 1996 immigration law, one of the items that was in that law was a requirement that anybody who was an undocumented immigrant who was given a jail sentence of a year or more had to be transported back to their home countries after they had served their prison sentence. To go back a little bit before this, when Central American refugees began coming here in the 1980s, They initially formed gangs in places like L.A. and Chicago and other large cities to protect their own families and communities and neighborhoods against other gangs that were already powerful and in existence. So it was, these were not gangs that were involved for the most part in criminal activities. These were kids who were displaced, who were not welcomed, obviously, into the United States, who didn't have legal status here. And the gangs provided for displaced youth and impoverished youth a way to have a community, a way to feel empowered by being able to own and be trained in using of weapons.
So you had, like, Mexican, Salvadoran,
yes.
African-American.
Yes. This is right, exactly. In my father's day in Boston, it was the Jews versus the Irish. He remembers, you know, kids beating each other up in gangs, territorial lines being drawn. Guns weren't used at that time as
the
they were being
the
now.
Jets.
The Sharks and the Jets from, you know, the famous musical of Leonard Bernstein, West Side Story. So this kind of gang infighting had gone on for years, but the amount of violence that was part of what was happening in the ghettos of the cities in the 1980s and 90s was unprecedented. So the United States government began to deport these young criminals after they had served a year or more in jail. And they deported in the last decade of the 20th century, in the first decade of the 21st century, they deported 880,000 Mexican criminals. The former mayor of Ciudad Juarez says, what the United States government would often do is drop them off at the end of the bridge, from the bridge across to El Paso, and leave them on their own. There was no information given to any of these governments about the criminal nature of these young men. They were just sent back. The FBI would provide information if governments asked, but the governments had no idea who these young people were. So you have 880,000 criminals going back to Mexico in two decades who are displaced. And in Central America, there are 300,000 who are going back in the 1990s and the early 21st century. Many of these are kids who grew up speaking English, who have absolutely no attachment to their home countries, whose families are long gone, either killed or displaced, or who don't want to take them in. Where are they going to go to find community? They recreate the gang structures that they had in the cities of the United States and that they continued in jail. And they are now, the two most powerful of them, the Mara Salvatrucha and the MS-18, are international gangs, and they have the same symbols and emblems and clothing. They go back and forth between various countries of Central America and sometimes travel to the United States. So we have transnational gang organizations that are throughout the United States in urban centers as well as in Central America, helping to create a great deal of this violence.
Now, are these the folks behind drug trafficking?
Yes and no. The United States began its war on drugs in the 80s with a huge initiative in Colombia. As some Americans might remember, hundreds of billions of dollars were spent against trying to break up the Medellin cartel. The Merida initiative began in Mexico in the 1990s, and the two biggest drug cartels, the Sinaloa cartel and the Zetas in Mexico, were not exactly forced out of Mexico, but found that they could survive much better if they transferred many of their most important operations to what is called the Northern Triangle, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And the great thing about them being able to transfer the drug operations there is that the areas in which they do most of the shipping the intermediary shipping from South America of the drugs coming from Bolivia and Colombia and Peru is that the areas of these countries where they have set up their airplane bases and their drop-off bases are in hundreds of thousands of acres of jungle where nobody can penetrate, and they have access to arms from United States, free sale of arms to criminal gangs and anyone we want to sell arms to, so that they literally can't be found. They're scattered all over the place. 90% of the cocaine that comes into the United States now comes from the Northern Triangle. 10 years ago, it was 40% of South American cocaine. So this is now the central corridor of where drug traffic is coming into the U.S.
And at least some of it is run by these former gang members.
Well, the cartels have started alliances with these gangs, the MS-18 and the Mara Salvatrucha, which are the two biggest. They began by using them as protection for their safe houses. They began by using them they're now using them as transportistas, helping to guard some of the places where they're keeping the drugs. They're now using them in the last 5 or 6 years to do some of the execution work they want done. And they pay the gangs in kind, which means the gangs are getting small amounts of cocaine and heroin that they can sell on the streets to make their own money. And what this has created is intensified gang warfare to extraordinary proportions in many of the rural areas of Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras, to the point where some of these gangs actually are the governmental authorities in small villages and cities. They're given plots, they're given pieces of land where they're allowed to just do their own thing and the government doesn't bother them. But the government is also in alliance with many of these gangs. The president of El Salvador used Mara 13, the Salvatruchas, to help get out the vote for his last election. The president of Honduras, according to our former ambassador to the Organization of American States, is a narco trafficker. So the incentive for these governments to crack down on the gangs and on the cartels isn't really very huge.
We're talking to historian Lois Rudnick about the refugee crisis and the human crisis in Central America, and we were talking about drug trafficking. Now, who is consuming all these drugs that we're talking about?
Well, here we have the number one criminal are the U.S. consumers of drugs. 90% of the drugs that go through the Northern Triangle are coming to the United States. So this is a market-driven crisis. And the United States government and federal agencies and state agencies, rather than addressing the issues of why we have this kind of drug problem in the United States, essentially is putting most of its money into the militarization of Central America, which has only created more human rights abuse, because a lot of these, the police and security forces who are being trained to try to get the gangs out of their cities and rural areas and to deal with the cartels, are landing on the backs of youth who have been sometimes abducted into and sometimes coerced into these criminal organizations at the threat of the death of their families and their siblings, etc. So we are putting our energies into efforts that have yielded nothing in terms of in any way stopping the flow of drugs to the United States and have only made human rights abuses, particularly femicides, which is a word that means the targeting of women through rape and torture and murder. Most of them are human rights workers in Central America, and the numbers of femicides have tripled in Honduras in the last few years and doubled in some of the other countries.
Why is Honduras in particularly bad shape right now?
40% of Hondurans are under the age of 15. Two-thirds live in dire poverty. In 2009, there was a military coup, and the government has been unstable. The Obama administration has still been giving billions of dollars to Honduras and these other governments to try to end the drug traffic. And a lot of that money and energy has gone to the suppression of peasants who have tried to form, who have tried to create a social movement to demand protection of their land rights. I mean, most of the people who've been targeted since the beginning of these civil wars are students, union leaders, priests, nuns, and peasants. So Honduras is really in a state, as Allegra put it last week on your show, of absolute rampant implosion of its infrastructure.
And so not only is there no work, but there's no safety. And as we talked about, they're riding on the top of freight trains across many hundreds of miles to try to get here. It seems to me that we've had this problem in the United States for a really long time, as long as I've been conscious, and maybe this is our whole history. I don't know. You can tell us. You're the historian. But we try to solve problems with guns and bombs
right.
blades and things that hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
And that often doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work. In fact, it's the United States is a victim throughout the history of its immigration policies of the law of unintended consequences. I'm sure we did not intend in giving money to train security forces in and give police forces more arms and more help to create more human rights abuses and have those very forces that are supposed to be dealing with the gangs and the drug cartels use their arms and repression on their own people the way that they have so often done. But we, you know, I just would like to talk about one other, I think, important factor in the history of all of this has to do with our creation of what was once called the School of the Americas, that we started in 1946 in Panama and moved to the United States in 1984. It's still at Fort Benning, Georgia, under a much nicer name that doesn't sound like it does anything problematic. But in the years between 1946 and 2001, when its name changed, and mostly in the years of the 1980s and 90s, we trained 60,000 military at that school that went just for the El Salvadorian and Guatemalan governments. And many of the people we trained in torture, execution, and many other kinds of uses of violence that were against our own human rights laws and international UN human rights laws ended up being involved in some of the most brutal violence and human rights problems in Central America. Several of the dictators who've run those countries were trained in this school. And just to quote one horrific sentence from one of the seven manuals of abuse that one Vietnam vet calls it the School of the Assassins, because that's essentially what they were trained to do.
You're talking about manual, like training manuals.
Training manuals, yes. They were taught how to kidnap people, how to execute them, how to torture them, how to get ransom for dead bodies. And to quote one of these manuals, who were they supposed to target? They were supposed to target insurgents. Who were the insurgents? They were priests. They were nuns. They were labor leaders. They were students. And, this is a direct quote, anybody who tried to help the poor.
Ladies and gentlemen, and what you have is an area of the world in which it's actually possible for large numbers of people to have basic subsistence cultures, societies that can really last a long time and from whom, if they were doing that, we could actually learn a thing or two because we don't do sustainable agriculture and things like that.
Exactly.
And it's precisely those people who were living lightly on the land and kind of not hurting anybody who are targeted, whereas the people who are making it are the super wealthy, the military, the cartels, and the gangs.
And this is why it's so hard to disaggregate economic refugees from political refugees, Mary Charlotte. I mean, Steve Pierce recently went down to Artesia and said, well, these are economic refugees. Well, how are we not implicated in the economic problems of these countries when, for example, in the last few years, Guatemala has been exporting half of its corn to the United States for ethanol and biofuels, and the price of tortillas, which is the basic staple of the Guatemalan peasant diet, has doubled, and families can't afford it. Our own economic policies are implicated in the poverty, displacement of families, the undermining of social structures and community structures that have made the gangs increase in power and the cartels increase in power in this area of Central America.
Another example of the law of unintended consequences is something you talked about. It's like, okay, let's get these gangsters off the street. Let's get these felons out of here. And you send them away, but it's the same thing that people say about garbage. There is no away.
Right, exactly. As we know from seeing the movie E.T., it's going to go somewhere. And it is unconscionable for us to send criminals who've been part of our prison system back to their quote-unquote home countries, which really for most of them aren't home countries by the time they get back there, and not provide any information to the powers that be in these countries, at least the ones that might not be corrupted by the sale of arms, which is another factor, the fact that 90 out of the 94,000 guns that the Mexican government reappropriated from the cartels, 70% had been sold to the United States from the United States.
And that is our gun rights.
Yeah, right.
In other words, you can go into a store,
right,
and buy 73
right.
guns and
Correct.
Walk out and then
right.
cross the border into Mexico
exactly.
without further ado. Yeah.
And most of the gangs, when they got started, their cache of guns came from what was left over during the Civil Wars. And most of those had been supplied by the United States to their governments.
So we've been talking about things that are probably sending some of our more sensitive listeners into states of utter and complete despair. What are we supposed... I mean, it's like you've... Describe, if you want to create a perfect storm of horror over
yes.
50 years,
yes.
here's how you do it.
You got it. But
how do you undo it?
There are many things we could be doing, and I would be happy to share some of the ideas that I've garnered from many of the fantastic reports I've been reading over the last couple of months from various organizations who really have thoughtfully about this, from the United States Catholic Bishops Conference to Human Rights Watch. One of the things we could do is to decriminalize drug possession. One of the best things that's happened in the United States recently has been the beginning of the legalization of marijuana, not just medical marijuana, but the possession of marijuana. If we stopped criminalizing drug possession, we might be able to have about one-third of the number of people in prison in the United States that we have today, most of them young men, many of them young black men and young Hispanic men, as well as undocumented immigrants.
And if we went so far as places like Colorado and Washington actually
yes,
legalizing
right.
drugs, which I have heard some reports, and we needed more information on this, have actually hurt the drug cartels.
Yes.
In those states.
Yes. No, I think that one of the most important things the United States could do on a federal level is to legalize marijuana at the federal level. So it's not up to states to wonder if the feds under some other president might come in and start arresting people.
But hang on. Is
yeah.
the drugs that are coming from Bolivia and Peru and so on,
right.
those are cocaine?
We're talking about decriminalizing drug possession of
so not
all
just
drugs.
Marijuana.
We're talking about legalizing marijuana and decriminalizing drug possession of whatever kind. Not the sale of cocaine, not the sale of heroin or of methamphetamine, but to decriminalize the possession of these drugs. Of course, we should be addressing our own domestic policies and economic problems which fuel the demand for illegal drugs. It's no coincidence that some of the largest methamphetamine production sites in the United States are in rural America and in deindustrialized states where there is tremendous unemployment and poverty.
And I think it's important to emphasize that there's two things going on. One is that you can make money selling drugs,
yep.
and the other is in places of high poverty, a lot of people are self-medicating.
Yes.
And they're using those
absolutely,
drugs.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for that clarification. We also have a category, as of 1980, and this law is up for contention right now among the Republicans and Democrats, of unaccompanied alien children, who in a 1980 law were given the protection if they were fleeing countries because they were subject to violence or sex trafficking or who were smuggled here. So many child advocates are suggesting that we should, and the Democrats are also saying, we should be using that 1980 law to protect these children because they are refugees. They are not economic. They're not fleeing for economic reasons, though, of course, economic reasons are part of the reasons for the violence that are sustained in their countries. The best interest of child care should be applied. The UAC is supposed to afford legal counsel to any child who comes here and claims asylum. Most of these children are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Very few of them even know they have the right to ask for asylum. And so we need human rights advocates and child rights advocates to be there at the border and at these places that are hosting them, like in Artesia and elsewhere, to help these children understand what their rights are and to help them advocate for asylum. Between 40 to 60% of the kids who are coming here, according to many of the organizations whose white papers I've read, potentially qualify to stay here under our current immigration and refugee laws. And this is a key. Almost every child who has representation from a lawyer who is in this situation wins their case.
Is that right?
Yes. Judges are now typically denying 7 out of 10 cases. So many of the advocates for these children say the judges need to have information about the situations in their country. Many of these children, it's I flee to the United States or I stay home and die. And that is not hyperbole.
Right.
There's one young girl from Honduras who was interviewed recently who said, well, I stopped taking public transportation when the gangs began to blow up the buses when the bus drivers wouldn't pay protection money. With all the people in them. Okay, there's another law we have on the books called Temporary Protected Status, TPS, for these refugees. In 1990, Congress passed legislation allowing the president to grant TPS to certain groups in need of a temporary safe haven. What that meant was people who are not able to safely return to their countries. That sometimes applied to people who were victims of earthquakes and typhoons, but it also applied to people who were coming from countries where there was tremendous armed conflict going on. Now, it's not a long-term solution. It's a more like 40 to 60-day solution, but it provides time to figure out whether or not these people are asylum candidates or can be asylum candidates. Migration from the Northern Triangle has increased by 712% to contiguous countries in the last 2 years. The U.S. could provide support regionally, not just to Mexico, but to Nicaragua, Belize, Costa Rica, and Panama, so they can implement protection policies for these refugees and share the burden with us. It makes so much more sense to give millions of dollars in aid for this kind of help than to build up more militarization of our border that is already hyper-militarized.
You know, and the thing is, I mean, we talk about, I'm just going to bring it up again, militarization has its place. I mean, there is a place for the military.
Yes, there is.
From time to time. But when it becomes this big, bloated, lumbering, sprawling bureaucracy, which sucks up so much of the money that we earn and pay in taxes,
yep,
it's not necessarily the right use of that
right.
money. I mean, in other words, you have an institution in place
right.
to solve a different problem than the real problem you've got.
And it's counter-effective.
Yeah.
If it were having a good effect, Mary Charlotte, we may say, okay, continue it. But there is absolutely no evidence that we have stopped drug trafficking, that less cocaine is coming into this country, and that any of the violence in these countries has in any way decreased as a result of our militarization of police, security forces, and the military.
And every once in a while you hear stories of CIA planes
right.
being used for drug running and things like
that. Well, I remember that from the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and
very
and
vividly.
Beyond. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. The U.S. could engage in, to follow up on your point, there is no reason we can't be giving money to skill-based training, employment, and education. Most of the kids in these three countries don't even have access to education, let alone quality education. What if we helped to build infrastructure? What if, for example, we forced the Guatemalan government to put into effect one of the requirements of the 1996 peace accord that their wealthy businessmen refused to put into effect? The World Bank and the IMF said to Guatemala, you need to increase taxation on business to the extent that 12% of GDP comes from taxes. That is the minimum you need to recreate your infrastructure and provide public safety and health and education to your population. They refuse to implement that, and no one has pushed them to do it. Why? Since we're their primary supplier of weapons and economic aid, why aren't we pushing them to do that? We should stop the drug war, the failed drug war, and work on public safety and prevention here as well as in those countries. This is a wonderful organization Allegra mentioned called Kind Kids in Need of Defense, which is one of the national organizations that are supplying pro bono lawyers for refugee kids. They have started a repatriation and reintegration program in Guatemala that has shown to be very successful for the deportees who are sent back so they don't immediately go from deportation into gangs.
That's huge.
That is, again, this is another place we could be investing economic aid. So if you think about the fact that we've spent $350 million in economic aid to these three countries under the Obama administration in the last year, whereas the remittances from the refugees already in this country and immigrants already in this country are $4 billion from each country a year, sustaining what little is being sustained in those countries, you have to ask yourself, why aren't we investing so much more money into reintegration, into having the ICE follow through the criminals that are deported?
You know, it reminds me, it's like if you don't want to have abortions, have birth control.
Exactly.
If you don't want to have immigration, healthy, sustainable countries with some semblance
Absolutely.
Of equality, democracy.
Absolutely. Here's a couple of other things that could be done without Congress's authorization. We can process asylum requests in the home countries. We have done this with Vietnamese, with Cambodians, and with Haitians. It would
Very
cost a $300 plane ride and no coyotes. The average amount that Central American families are spending to send their kids here is $5,000 to $7,000, an 18-month family income in Honduras, and many of those children end up dead in prostitution. We know all the stories from listening to Allegra and reading the newspapers. If there's a legal way and children and families know it, they will wait. We should also, after 9/11, we decreased the number of refugees authorized to come to this country from 90,000, which it's been since after World War II, to 70,000. There's no reason we can't increase that to 90,000, since none of these people are terrorists, even those who end up in jail doing drugs. We're not talking about terrorists from the Middle East. The sanctuary movement is reviving itself. I think religious organizations can do even more. This wonderful minister from the church that began the sanctuary movement in 1980 has taken in one family from Sinaloa, which is where the Sinaloa drug cartel is located, or at least it began, and successfully defended their right to stay in the United States because their lives are in danger. And we can certainly see a recreation of that happening here. There are many organizations that were formed in the 80s that are still working to help immigrants with food, shelter, and legal representation.
And there's so many people who want to help. I mean,
yes.
there's a kind of picture painted in the media of these belligerent, hostile protesters, but there are just as many, and I suspect way more open-hearted people who want to do their share.
Absolutely, and I will give you one of them. This would be a Presidential Medal of Freedom given to Nora Sandigo of Miami, who has become the legal guardian of 812 children of mixed-status family whose parents have been deported. A quarter of the people deported are parents of U.S. citizens. We have been deporting 100,000. We have been deporting the parents of 100,000 American children a year, whom our own ICE Immigration Commission calls immigrant orphans, who would then have to be put into foster homes.
Yeah.
So she, by taking legal control of these children, becoming their guardian, these kids can stay in this country, live with parents and friends, and not be in fear of taken into custody. And last but not least, comprehensive immigration reform decoupled from militarization of the border.
Lois Rudnick is a historian and has been working on this whole set of issues around Central America, along with all the many other projects that you do, cultural history, art history, and so on. For more information, I mean, I think this is the kind of thing that, ladies and gentlemen, if you want more information, just put aside an hour instead of watching TV some evening and maybe do a little bit of searching on the internet. You can certainly go to Kids in Need of Defense, KIND.
And Somos Un Pueblo Unido in Santa Fe, that for 20 years has been
very
doing remarkable work on protecting the rights of undocumented immigrants and workers.
Somos Un Pueblo Unido. And just inform yourself and be a good citizen. Lois Rudnick, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.